got a word for the way that we're dying. Well, a philosopher said in a book I read, our style of living will soon be dead.
We're now approaching Newport, Rhode Island.
KBOO and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present one of the great concert films of all time, Jazz on a Summer's Day, a documentary of the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. Jazz on a Summer's Day captures the music, the crowd, and the essence of such jazz greats as Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Mulligan, and Anita O'Day. Jazz on a Summer's Day, Thursday, August 14, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Old Rockin' Chair's got me.
Old Rockin' Chair got your father.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up this morning, we've got Sojourner Truth Radio, including an update on the Ukraine with investigative journalist Robert Perry. Also, author and journalist Danny Schechter, along with Monadel Herzallah, discuss the situation on the ground in Gaza, the tentative ceasefire, and what action people in the U.S. can take. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascade with your host, Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Today, we'll hear an update on Haiti, among other topics. And at 11 o'clock, it's The Dirt Bag with gardening tips and tricks. Today, host Glenn Andreessen and guest Jim Gilbert talk pears, varieties, harvesting, ripening, and also be prepared for a garden stumper and news from the beehive. Thank you, all you KBOO members, for being members and listening and supporting us so generously. If you're not a member, you can easily go to kboo.fm and become a member by clicking where it says Donate Today. And now we're going to go right to Sojourner Truth Radio on KBOO.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and I'd like to thank all of you for supporting this show and KPFK during our recent summer fund drive. Today, an update on the Ukraine with investigative journalist Robert Perry and journalist and author Danny Schechter, along with Monadel Herzallah of the U.S. Palestine Community Network, discuss with us the situation on the ground in Gaza, the tentative ceasefire, and what actions people in the United States can take. As the U.S. bombing campaign in Iraq continues, as well as the U.S. arming of Kurdish fighters, the U.S. is now overtly involved in the civil war in Iraq. Meanwhile, a new prime minister has been named, one approved of by the United States in Iran and Iran. But the present prime minister, al-Maliki, is not going quietly. Meanwhile, the Obama administration is being criticized for his policy in Iraq from both the left and the right. Our guest is Tom Hayden, and our weekly Earth Minute returns with Ann Peterman of the Global Justice Ecology Project. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. President Obama has endorsed the Iraqi president's selection of the deputy parliamentary speaker to try to form a new government. Obama said he has spoken to Haider al-Abadi.
This is an important step towards forming a new government that can unite Iraq's different communities. Earlier today, Vice President Biden and I called Dr. Abadi to congratulate him and to urge him to form a new cabinet as quickly as possible, one that's inclusive of all Iraqis and one that represents all Iraqis.
Secretary of State John Kerry urged calm as Iraq faces a political crisis while battling advances by fighters of the Islamic State. Kerry said the country's new president is acting appropriately despite claims of malfeasance by the incumbent Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Yesterday, Maliki vowed to fight the decision to choose a new prime minister.
I tell all the fighters on the front lines, the volunteers and members of the armed forces, including the police and the army, who are worried about the violation of the Constitution and the attempt to circumvent it, to stay in your position and not to worry or be shaken by this constitutional violation. You are engaged in a sacred battle.
As the political crisis rages, the U.S. is arming Kurdish forces battling Islamic State fighters in the Kurdish north. Kerry said U.S. combat forces will not re-enter Iraq, but that the U.S. will explore more political, economic, and security options. A temporary truce is holding for a second day in the Israel-Gaza conflict. Indirect negotiations on a lasting ceasefire and a long-term solution for the battered Gaza Strip were set to resume in Cairo, Egypt. Israel said a small fishing boat from Gaza had violated an Israeli-imposed prohibition on going out to sea, but had turned back after an Israeli naval vessel fired several warning shots in its direction. A key Palestinian demand is an end to Israel's blockade of Gaza by sea, land, and air. Israel's month-long military offensive in Gaza killed more than 1,900 Palestinians, the majority of them civilians. 64 Israeli soldiers died. 3 civilians died in Israel. Police in riot gear fired tear gas into a crowd of protesters in the St. Louis suburb where an unarmed African-American teenager was fatally shot by police over the weekend. A community forum hosted by the local NAACP chapter last night drew hundreds to a church in Ferguson. That's the predominantly African-American suburb where 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot multiple times by a police officer. National NAACP President Cornell William Brooks urged residents to turn their anger into action. He also urged a thorough investigation.
We're calling for is not only a full and exhaustive investigation by the Justice Department, but also by the local authorities. This unfortunate, tragic shooting and death occurred in Ferguson, Missouri. Those who are here and on the ground need to assure the community that there will be a full accounting, that this officer will be held accountable.
The FBI has opened a probe into Brown's death, looking into possible civil rights violations. Witnesses have said Brown had his hands raised when the unidentified officer approached with his weapon drawn and fired repeatedly. A convoy of 280 Russian trucks reportedly packed with aid headed for eastern Ukraine today, but the central Ukrainian government said it would only allow the goods through under the close supervision of the International Red Cross. The humanitarian crisis provoked by fighting between government troops and pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine has reached a critical point in recent days. Ukraine and Western nations have claimed Russia could use the aid initiative as a cover for sending troops into separatist-held territory. Russia dismissed those accusations as nonsense. Marin County officials in Northern California will have more to say today about the apparent suicide of actor and comedian Robin Williams. The sheriff's department has scheduled a morning briefing. Williams was found dead at his home in Tiburon yesterday. He recently had been suffering from severe depression. Entertainment Weekly dubbed Williams the funniest man alive in 1997. He also took on serious roles in the movies. He was praised for those roles, including in Good Morning Vietnam in 1987.
Good morning, Vietnam! Hey.
Williams won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for his performance as the therapist who counseled Matt Damon's math genius in Good Will Hunting. Robin Williams dead at the age of 63. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we begin our show with a tribute to Robin Williams. Sad news about his death. His wife, Susan Schneider, said in a statement, quote, "This morning I lost my husband and my best friend, while the world lost one of its most beloved artists and beautiful human beings. beings. Let's go to a clip from the BBC about Robin Williams.
It was this zany alien that propelled Robin Williams to stardom. Mork and Mindy was a huge TV hit in the late 1970s and early 80s, and he was soon making himself heard on the big screen.
Good morning, Vietnam!
It won him a Golden Globe and an Oscar nomination.
Look at me, son.
His versatility and talent eventually rewarding him with an Academy Award for Good Will Hunting.
This might be the one time I'm speechless.
But it's his comic roles he'll best be remembered for.
Euphrigenia Doubtfire, dear. I specialise in the education and entertainment of children.
He was due to start filming a follow-up to his famous role as Mrs. Doubtfire next year. Robin Williams was discovered unconscious and pronounced dead at his home in Northern California. The coroner suspects suicide. He'd struggled with drug and alcohol addiction and was suffering from depression.
My heart is broke today. My heart is broke. I mean, Robin was a national treasure. He's a comedic legend, a dramatic legend. He will be missed. He will be missed.
But world cinema has lost one of his biggest stars.
One only hopes that, he's gone to a good place.
Grieving fans came to pay tribute at his star on Hollywood's Walk of Fame.
He was one of the greatest men alive.
Yes.
And I'm going to miss him a lot. And today the comedy died.
Robin Williams was one of those rare talents whose work crossed generations from the 1970s of Mork and Mindy through Mrs. Doubtfire, all those characters he created on screen, on television. And he's someone who, from what we've been hearing from Twitter and from all those comments from around the world, will be sorely missed.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we're starting out with a brief tribute to Robin Williams, who died on Monday at his home in Northern California, north of San Francisco. He was 63 years old. His publicist has said that he had been battling a severe depression. Of course, he is very well known and loved for his work, including his work on the television series Mork and Mindy, film roles such as Good Morning Vietnam, Dead Poets Society, The Fisher King, and as we just heard, winning the Oscar in 1998 for Good Will Hunting. He was born in Chicago on July 21st, 1951. He studied acting at the Juilliard School. He's survived by his children, a son, Zach, his daughter, Zelda, and another son, Cody. Robin Williams, dead at the age of 63. We now turn our attention to the continued and growing crisis in the Ukraine. Government officials in Kiev announced today that a Russian aid convoy, a humanitarian convoy, would not be allowed to cross the border into eastern Ukraine. The decision is an apparent reversal from yesterday's statement by Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko that the Russian aid would be accepted as part of an international relief effort aimed at relieving civilians living in the war-torn cities of Donetsk and Luhansk. Fighting between pro-Russian separatists and the central government in Kiev has raged in the eastern part of Ukraine since April of this year. Now, there are estimates that those killed range anywhere from 1,500 to 10,000 people and displacing almost 30,000 more, many of those fleeing across the border into Russia. Civilians living in that part of the country now face food and water shortages, along with dwindling supplies and medicine. Despite the worsening humanitarian situation in eastern Ukraine, both Kiev and its western backers, including the United States, have remained hostile to the suggested aid convoy, arguing it will serve as a cover for a Russian land invasion. That in contrast to the U.S. humanitarian aid going on now in Iraq, along with a bombardment of Iraq and arming Kurdish fighters. Meanwhile, sanctions on Russia have been imposed by the U.S. and Europe. In return, Russia has banned food imports from the U.S. and Europe. The euro is falling, the market shaky as a result of the sanctions, and British food exporters are very hard hit. Now, also, Russia was blamed for the downing of the Malaysian Airlines that is killing hundreds of people. We all remember those images, and the Kiev government was very, very quick to say that Russia was to blame for it. We would now like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Robert Parry. He's an award-winning investigative journalist and editor of Consortium News. He broke many of the Iran-Contra stories in the 1980s. He's written several books, including Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George Bush, and Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Robert Parry, thank you for yet again joining us.
Thanks for having me, Margaret.
What we're going to do, Robert, we're going to just hear a short report from the BBC on the convoy.
Well, Russian television this morning showed pictures of what it claimed was this humanitarian aid convoy leaving an area southwest of Moscow, bound for eastern Ukraine. Russian TV said there were 280 trucks packed with 2,000 tons of aid, things like sugar and grain and medicine, sleeping bags, and electricity generators. It said the convoy had been organized by Russia's Ministry for Emergency Situations and would arrive at its destination in between 2 and 3 days, and that it would be met at the border by the International Red Cross. Now, we haven't heard from the Red Cross this morning, but yesterday, President Putin announced that Russia was sending a humanitarian aid convoy and that that had been agreed with the Red Cross. The Red Cross responded to that yesterday by saying it was prepared to facilitate such a humanitarian mission. But first, there were details that needed to be clarified. We don't know if those details have been clarified. As I say, we haven't heard from the Red Cross this morning. But a Kremlin spokesman told me earlier today that the Red Cross had agreed and that the authorities in Kiev had also agreed to the Russian convoy.
Okay, so Robert Parry, I do want to talk about the situation on the ground happening now with the convoy, but we have to put this in some context, and I'd like to go back to the downing of the Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. So many sadly killed, including the majority Dutch nationals. And you have what is considered by some a rather controversial article in Consortium News related to that Malaysia Airlines shoot down, and the title is "Was Putin Targeted for Mid-Air Assassination?" Now, Robert Parry, I had heard some talk about that at the time, you know, shortly after the plane was downed, and had really set it aside as something that just couldn't possibly be the case. So it piqued my interest to see your article on this. Tell us what your thoughts are. What did you have in this article?
Well, the problem with the case of the Malaysian airline flight was that initially many assumed that it might have been the rebels shooting down this plane, perhaps by accident, thinking it was a Ukrainian military aircraft.
Yeah.
But then the question became, did they have the missiles that would have been necessary to do that? The plane was flying at 33,000 feet. And the shoulder-fired missiles that the rebels were known to have wouldn't have been able to get that high. So the Ukrainian government alleged that the Russians had provided some very sophisticated Buk missile batteries, three of them, I think they claimed, and that one of them was fired by the rebels and took down the Malaysian airline plane, killing 298 people. However, the evidence was always very thin, and when U.S. intelligence analysts began to look back at what they had to either confirm or challenge that assumption, they weren't able to come up with the evidence. They didn't have it. What evidence they had in terms of satellite surveillance and other intercepts and other information actually tended to go in a different direction, I'm told, which was that some element of the Ukrainian military and government were responsible for the attack. And that's the is now the working assumption among some of the U.S. intelligence analysts. And so they began also looking at why this might have happened, and they have gone back through this idea of whether or not there may have been some extremist faction within the Ukrainian government that thought that since President Putin was flying back from South America on that same day, July 17th, and his flight path was expected to either come in through over Ukraine, which is a normal flight path to Moscow or nearby, they could have mistaken the Malaysian aircraft, which had similar markings to Putin's plane, and fired on it, thinking they were trying to take down Putin. So the point of the article was not that that is the case, but that this is one of the scenarios now being examined by U.S. intelligence. Basically, what I'm told from a source who's been briefed on this information, the case is the scenario is now has altered inside that area of the U.S. government that's investigating this, with the suspicions moving away from the rebels who they don't think had the weapon necessary to take down the plane, to elements of the Ukrainian government. Now, I'm also told by the same source that the U.S. intelligence analysts are saying that President Poroshenko and Prime Minister Yatsenyuk were not implicated in the information they're looking at. They're looking at information that there were some extremists, possibly one of the oligarchs who is now associated with the government, and extremist elements of the Ukrainian military, as being the possible culprits in this terrible incident.
Yeah, and certainly you have written before, and we have discussed the fact that they were extremists, some of whom are neo-Nazis, that were involved in the quote-unquote revolution that happened that displaced the democratically elected president of the Ukraine, who was pro-Russia and was replaced with Yanukovych. And actually that some of these extremist elements had some power within the post-coup government.
Right. There were several ministries, four or five, depending on how you want to count them, that were turned over to these neo-Nazis because they played such a key role in the actual overthrow of Yanukovych on February 22nd. It was these well-trained neo-Nazi street fighters coming from Western Ukraine who moved to the front of the Maidan demonstrations as they grew more violent, and ultimately got rid of what was left of the Yanukovych government after he pulled his police back. Then buildings were taken over by these neo-Nazi militias, so organized in groups of 100, and so they were very well organized and very violent. And then the new government was formed in part because there was an effort to sort of create a somewhat legitimate form of government, but it had to recognize the power of these neo-Nazi groups. And so they were given a number of the ministries, including national security. One of the most notorious of the neo-Nazis, Andriy Parubuy, was made head of national security. He just resigned last week, by the way. But we've also now seen in this recent offensive, and this came out in a brief reference in the New York Times, and the Telegraph of London has also had a piece on this, that many of the fighters that are being thrown against the ethnic Russians in the East are from these neo-Nazi militias. They basically have the way the attacks are going in the East is that the Ukrainian military will fire artillery and soften up the targets, even if they're residential, and then these neo-Nazi militias will move in and do the street fighting. They're very motivated. They despise the ethnic Russians, and so they're being unleashed on them. One of the towns outside of Donetsk, which was liberated or conquered, however you want to look at it, had a Nazi banner flying over the town, according to the New York Times, which just mentioned this in passing in a long story on the developments in Ukraine. So, yes, these neo-Nazi groups remain very important to what's happening on the ground in Ukraine.
Yeah, and you know, for the public at large, including for our listeners, you know, some of this is really difficult to absorb because there's been such a bombardment of what one, I think, is has been a lot of propaganda on the part of mainstream media, taking the line of the State Department, whatever that might be. And the fact that the story has now changed about what happened with that Malaysia Airlines flight 17 is sort of gone under the radar a bit. But I did want to ask you, though, about that story. I mean, one of the things that we were bombarded with was this intercepted phone call of alleged pro-Russian rebels making a phone call to what was said to be a Russian military officer of some sort, admitting to shooting down the flight, although it was unclear how this could be verified. And the other thing that we saw was a truck that was allegedly going across in broad daylight, by the way, into Russia, allegedly carrying a Buk missile.
Right. Well, some of this, of course, came from the Ukrainian government, so it's always hard to ascertain the authenticity of some of this. But even if there was a phone call, it's very possible that the rebels initially did think they shot down a plane. They were shooting down some of the lower-flying Ukrainian military planes, and even if those, let's assume for a second though that those that conversation is a legitimate conversation, one that could be verified, the rebels are not the most organized people on earth. They have very weak command and control. There's a lot of confusion on the ground in terms of what's happening, and they might have initially believed that one of their people did shoot down a plane, and then determined later that they didn't. That sort of thing does happen, but the bigger question becomes: did they have the means to do it? Did they have the weapon system that could actually carry this out? And on that point, this is where the U.S. intelligence community has had trouble. They wanted to try to confirm that because basically the U.S. government's on the side of the Ukrainian government, and when the U.S. government began jumping to the same conclusion the Ukrainian government did, Secretary Kerry went on all five talk shows on the next Sunday and basically said that the rebels did it with the help of the Russians, the U.S. intelligence community was having difficulty because it couldn't find the evidence to support that. And obviously this is an area of intense intelligence interest where American satellites are focused to try to get as much good information as possible. And these Buk missile systems aren't easily hidden. The missiles are themselves like 16 feet long, and there are four of them in a battery, and they have to get hauled around by trucks. So the idea that this would be something that U.S. intelligence just would not know about is almost impossible to believe. And so that's where the stories began to crumble inside the U.S. intelligence community. Now, what finally the U.S. will come out and say? It's now been several weeks, and the U.S. government's been very silent in terms of what it's put out officially on what it now knows. And there have been demands from people, former U.S. intelligence officials, who say the U.S. should come out with whatever evidence it has. Does it have satellite photographs? What does it have?
Yeah.
And the silence has been sort of deafening. There's sort of a dog not barking problem here, because if the U.S. did have satellite photographs or other intelligence supporting the narrative that the rebels did it with Russian help, that information would have been put out very quickly. And the fact that there's been this silence itself suggests that there's a problem with the original narrative that the U.S. government was pushing.
Right. And just finally, there's so much more we need to discuss here, so we'll need to carry that on another day. But on this issue of the humanitarian aid that Russia is trying to bring in, and Kiev's hope that they're finally going to crush the rebels in eastern Ukraine, and the numbers of people killed, quite alarming, actually, and also the numbers of people injured. But there does seem to me, anyway, to be a bit of a double standard of them saying, well, you know, Russia won't be welcome. The humanitarian aid from Russia won't be welcome. But meanwhile, in the United States, in Iraq, the United States is dropping a humanitarian aid along with bombardment. And that seems to be perfectly fine with the mainstream media. Robert Perry.
Well, you can certainly also go back to, say, Libya, where the U.S. government intervened in a military fashion, along with other European countries, to attack Libya because of Gaddafi's offensive against groups he considered terrorists in the eastern part of Libya. This was, you know, back in 2011. And so, yes, there are constant double standards here. In fact, sometimes you have to say that if there weren't for double standards, there'd be no standards at all. And the U.S. government is taking an attitude that these ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine are somehow unworthy of humanitarian support.
Yeah.
The fact that the United States is now supporting neo-Nazi groups going into these cities to kill ethnic Russians is a rather startling development. And it was, you know, mentioned in the last three paragraphs of a long New York Times article on Sunday. We're now learning more about this. And some of these neo-Nazis, they were interviewed by the Telegraph of London, saying that they consider the ethnic Russians Untermenschen, that these are subhuman people. So you're now seeing the United States tolerating or helping these neo-Nazi militias to slaughter ethnic Russians, and we're acting like this is not a humanitarian crisis because we the U.S. are on the side of those doing the killing.
Yeah, and it is
a violation of our principles, I would suggest.
Yeah, and 280 truck convoy, and I saw a video of, you know, where the Russians were being very careful to show what was in the trucks. They even had a priest coming out and blessing the trucks, and the Kiev government had initially said that they would accept the aid, and now apparently that has turned their tune. But Robert Perry, we will have you back. We are out of time, so we are going to have to leave it there. But Robert Perry, award-winning investigative journalist, editor of ConsortiumNews.com, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All righty. We are now going to go to our weekly Earth Watch, which is back. And then following up, Danny Schechter and Monadel Herzala waiting in the wings to discuss the latest on Gaza.
Synthetic biology, or extreme genetic engineering, is, without any warning, on its way to a supermarket near you. Yeast and algae have been bioengineered to produce vanilla, stevia, and saffron, palm, and coconut oil substitutes. Green companies like Ecover are moving to incorporate this controversial new technology into everyday products, even though truly natural alternatives like coconut oil are readily available and can be sustainably sourced. So what is synthetic biology? According to Friends of the Earth, SynBio involves stripping organisms of their natural genes and replacing them with digitally created DNA codes to create new forms of life. Learning from the anti-GMO movement, however, food and biotechnology companies are attempting to replace the terms synthetic biology and SynBio with words like nature identical and sustainable. But with companies like Monsanto, DuPont, BP, Chevron, Cargill, and others in the mix, calling synthetic biology sustainable or natural is not just dangerous, it's just plain ridiculous. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
All righty, we are going to take our station break, and coming up, we'll be discussing Gaza and Iraq. We'll be right back.
This is Ed Asner. You're listening to Fearless Drive Time Radio, Sojourner Truth with host Margaret Prescott.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, on Saturday, August 9th, in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza, hundreds of thousands marched against Israel. Nearly a quarter of a million people, an estimated 170,000, marched in Cape Town, South Africa, and over 100,000 in London, England, on what was dubbed an International Day of Rage to condemn the bombardment of Gaza. The latest ceasefire took place on Monday, August 11th at midnight local time. And this was after a similar truce collapsed on Friday, August the 8th. Hamas charges that the temporary truce on Friday was broken when Israeli gunboats fired shells near an empty beach in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. A temporary truce has been holding for a second day now between Israel and Hamas with no rocket fire or casualties. Palestinian negotiators began talks with the Egyptians after meeting yesterday. The talks are dubbed indirect, whatever that might mean. Now, just today, Hamas has said that this is the last chance for a ceasefire with Israel, and Hamas unwilling to meet face-to-face in the Cairo talks. And Israel, on the other hand, is demanding that Hamas be disarmed in the talks, and Hamas, of course, rejects this demand. Now, the Palestinian people have paid a very, very heavy price. At least 1,938 Palestinian lives have been claimed since the onset of the assaults on July 8th. According to Gaza officials, around 429 of them are children. The vast majority of them civilians. Meanwhile, three Israeli civilians have been killed and 67 soldiers. 425,000 Palestinian people have been displaced and 12,000 homes, Palestinian homes, have been destroyed or damaged severely. And of course, a number of key infrastructure for Gaza, including a power plant, you know, has been hit. Meanwhile, in Southern California and Northern California, a series of actions are going to be taking place this coming week under the banner of Free Palestine, Boycott, Divest, Sanction. On August 13th at 7 in the morning, protesters will be meeting at the port of Los Angeles, they say, to protest Israeli apartheid. Every week, the Israeli owned Zim shipping line docks and unloads its cargo at the port in Long Beach. And there is information about this on the Sojourner Truth website. We do have now a short clip on the truce from Reuters. Let's go to that clip.
Israeli troops at the border of Gaza prepared for the night. The new 72-hour truce appeared to be holding. Israeli and Palestinian negotiators resumed indirect talks in Cairo on ending the month-old war. In Khan Yunis, Gaza, relatives cried over the body of Ihsan El-Aga, one of nine Palestinians killed in Israeli airstrikes and shelling on Sunday. Allahu Akbar! In Jerusalem, residents didn't think the ceasefire would last.
I think until people start talking and stop being violent, they won't do anything. But hopefully, it'll work.
A month of war has killed 1,938 Palestinians and 67 Israelis while devastating wide tracts of densely populated Gaza. Egypt's foreign ministry is urging both sides to work towards a comprehensive and lasting ceasefire agreement.
Now, I'd like to welcome to Sojourner Truth Monadel Hirsalah of the U.S. Palestine Community Network. Monadel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also on the line is Danny Schechter, who edits MediaChannel.org and blogs at the news outlet Dissector.net. He has written extensively on the Middle East, Africa, and author of the recently released Madiba, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. Danny Schechter, welcome back.
Thank you so much. My blog, just for the record, newsdissector.net.
Newsdissector.net. Thank you for that, Danny Schechter. Monadel, we are going to start with you because it does seem as though when the news couldn't get any worse, it actually does. You hail from Palestine. You've got family members there. What are you hearing about the impact of the people of Palestine, the civilian population in Palestine, Monadel?
Well, right now, there is no place that after the calm, during the 72 hours, the truce, people are devastating, watching their houses demolished, not having a safe place to go to. There's no bomb shelters to run to. So, as you mentioned on the numbers has risen to from 423, for example, children to 463 children. My last phone call a few hours ago with my relatives in Gaza, they were saying there is no one neighborhood was safe. There is no one house that did not lose one of their members. The infrastructure has been destroyed. We're speaking about this injustice that is taking place. How long would this last? And it's devastating to see all this taking place over 30 days of continuous brutal war against unarmed civilians. And people are, the death toll operation has already surpassed the death toll of any other operation that took place against the people of Gaza. We're very angry, very afraid, very fear. All children are feared against all this bombing for no reason. I am, we are speaking up against this injustice because we know that being silent on this is complicity, and we will never remain silent of this face of this crimes. People of Gaza has been living in an open, in the largest open air, prison in the world. Is unable to go, have their normal life in Gaza, and we are here. We're really.
Yeah.
Listening.
Yeah. And Monadel, much has been made of the Israeli saying that their goal is to destroy the tunnels under Gaza. I mean, the story changed about three times. First, it was the killing and kidnapping of the three teenagers. And then it had to do with the rocket fire coming over into Israel. And thirdly, it had to do with destroying those tunnels. Now, tell us your views on this, because aren't those tunnels also used to really, given the blockade on both sides, on the Egyptian side and on the Israeli side, for basic survival items for the people of Gaza? So what impact would destroying those tunnels have, Monadel Rezalah?
A tremendous impact. Let's not forget that the fact that the Israeli propaganda is repeating the same talking points, the same excuses they have been doing for years and years. Now we're talking about the tunnels. A few years ago, it was kidnapping of soldiers when they started the bombing of southern Lebanon. It was the PLO, it was Arafat before, it was other names. Now it is Hamas and the tunnels for the same reason. There is no reason for people to suffer collective punishment, depriving people of their life saving, the electricity, the water. All this has nothing to do with tunnels. Now, we don't want to talk about defending tunnels more than the nature attack, the nature inhuman, criminal attacks against very sensitive places like schools, hospitals, mosques, stuff. In addition to that,
yeah,
Gaza has suffered over 7 years of blockade. no way in and no way out. The tunnels were serving as one way to bring food, to bring materials, bring everything to continue a normal life for anybody. When the sea, you are unable to go. To, even fishermen are unable to go further than very small zone of fishing. So they had no other way to do except, you know, having to do the tunnels.
Right. And Danny Schechter, thank you, Amana Dell. Danny Schechter, bringing you into this discussion, I was interesting to note that 170,000 people marched in Cape Town, South Africa, protesting what is happening in Gaza, and also that the KUSATU, the trade union, the South African conglomerate of trade unions there, have issued a call asking for support by organized labor for, you know, to protest what is happening in South Africa. You have written about both South Africa as well as Gaza and the Middle East. And many people are saying that what is happening in Gaza is indeed a form of apartheid.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Noam Chomsky has been criticized because he's not a supporter of the BDS movement. But one of the reasons that he cites, he says, you know, the analogy between South Africa and Palestine, while it has some apparent similarities, he feels that, you know, Israel is worse than apartheid South Africa.
Mm.
To compare the two, you know, misses that crucial difference, that the policies in Israel have been more abusive and, you know, over a longer period of time, if you will. And so, you know, I don't want to play the game of, you know, which injustice is worse kind of thing, but it's certainly true that the people in South Africa feel a connection. And they feel a connection in part because of their own experience and their own compassion and concern. And we've never seen a demonstration on this scale before in South Africa. It's the biggest march since the, you know, final days of apartheid. And, you know, it showed, and it wasn't about, you know, South Africa, which is significant. And so the solidarity marches in London and this one last Saturday, you know, are indications. And there were also big marches, by the way, in the Yemen and other parts of the Middle East as well, in solidarity with Gaza. So, you know, this shows how this these developments are no longer just a local Israeli-Gaza confrontation, but have become a global issue, and a global issue in which everybody has to weigh in. You know, the UN, you know, has been reluctant to do anything, but now once their school was bombed, they denounced it as criminal. And you have a growing isolation of Israel in the world, which I don't think the Israelis fully appreciate because they live in a bubble of such chauvinistic arrogance that they can't really see or hear anybody else. They have a, you know, the immediate response to any question, any criticism is to discredit the person who's raising the criticism. I had this experience, and I wrote an essay this past week. It's been up on Op-Ed News, many other websites, ZNet, called Israel is bad for the Jews. And I'm just, you know, my point was, you know, that Israel, because of its power, because of its PR skills, because of its political support in the United States, has become identified as Jewry, you know, as world Jewry. It tries to speak for all Jews, and of course it does not. And so in a way, this is destroying the Jewish community, too. And so I wrote this essay, and the response to it from after it appeared on JewishReporter.com was, you know, a blizzard of attacks on me as a Jew hater, as an anti-Semite, as a, you can imagine, okay, is worse than Hamas.
Right, yeah. And of course, you, along with members of the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, must be self-hating, right, Danny?
Well, this is the rap, you know.
Yeah.
I try to challenge all of this because I find it personally offensive to my family, offensive to, you know, thousands of years, you know, of tradition. It's interesting, you know, in addition to that letter, I received another one I'd like to read.
It shows if it's really short, because we are literally out of time.
All right. Well, it says, you know, I've lived in Israel for 13 years. I have 3 children, 5 grandchildren there, including 2 now in the army and 1 just out. I couldn't agree with you more. Those who are shouting to silence you are really trying to silence their own consciences. So this goes on. But nevertheless, there is a lot of sentiment in Israel that's been intimidated in many ways, but is challenging this Gaza onslaught.
Right. And Monadel Herzlah of the U.S. Palestine Community Network, for people who want to get in touch with you or to find out more about these protests, because we haven't had a chance to discuss it, but there's a lot of work that needs to happen inside the United States, because Israel would not be able to do what they're doing without U.S. military and other support. And as I mentioned earlier, there is a protest in Los Angeles on tomorrow morning, actually, August 13th at 7 o'clock at the Port of Long Beach, 700 Pier A Plaza. The zip code for that is 90813, and it's being called by BDS, Boycott, Divest, Sanctions, LA, for Justice in Palestine, American Muslims for Palestine, U.S. Palestinian Community Network, the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, Labor, Global Women's Strike, and there are also other supporters. Monadel, for people who want to find out what will be happening in other parts of California and to be in touch with your organization, what should they do?
They can look us up at the internet. The website is uspcn.org.
Okay.
US Palestinian Community Network.org.
And in Los Angeles, it's bdsinla@gmail.com. Well, Monadel Herzlah, we hope you will join us again. And Danny Schechter, always good to have you. Thank you so much, Margaret. We are now going to welcome Tom Hayden, who likely needs a little introduction. And with the short time that we have, we will skip it. We're also going to skip the clip. We had a great clip from the Financial Times to play on what is happening in Iraq. But Tom Hayden, welcome.
Skip along.
Okay. So now you have the U.S., quote unquote, protecting the Yazidis. You've got the Pentagon basically saying they're really unsure how many Yazidis there actually are. Turkey is keeping them out and sending them back across the border. There's been a shakeup in Baghdad with al-Abada being the new prime minister replacing al-Maliki. And clearly the United States is now siding with the Kurds, it seems, including arming the Kurds, and the Yazidis seem to be the excuse for doing that. Tom Hayden, your assessment on what's going on?
I think the fact that Hillary Clinton is pushing Barack Obama towards a more military approach reveals how little space Obama has. And this phenomenal offensive by ISIS, which has been going on for months, has been underestimated consistently. I don't know if it's because of racism or a desire to see the world through rose-colored glasses, but you have a hell of a mess. And there was almost a coup last night in Baghdad. I think the main point is that the United States has installed and funded and armed and looked the other way towards a client regime that is Shia, authoritarian, and repressive for several years. And the Sunnis have been disenfranchised, people who were formerly in power, now out of power, disenfranchised, identity disenfranchisement. I mean, Maliki even arrested his Sunni vice president last year and drove him out of the country. Mm. So replacing Maliki is only a shallow first step. It's a big question whether you can force into a stand down the entire Shiite repressive regime, including special forces, the military, and the police, and guarantee the Sunni Iraqis a fair share of power, resources, their own security in Anbar and Nineveh and the provinces to the north, in the hopes that they might prefer to be in partial power in Iraq, as opposed to giving up their Iraq identity and becoming part of the ISIS concept of a global caliphate with Mr. al-Baghdadi as the supreme emir. I don't think it's possible to know what's going to happen, but you know, it's not a pretty picture, and there's no simple way out. I think the Congressman McGovern and maybe Barbara Lee they have a war powers resolution vote pending when everybody gets back from vacation. But I'm not sure what good that will do because the situation is collapsing by the day.
Yeah, and Tom Hayden, I mean, looking again at what's happening with the U.S., I mean, and the Kurds, the area that the U.S. is focused on is reported, at least according to Reuters, to be a headquarters of sorts for the Kurds. And the U.S. has also sent hundreds of military advisors along with the airstrikes, but they're also arming the Kurds. Now, these are forces in the ethnic Kurdish region, and one has to, and the British, meanwhile, they're dropping food and quote-unquote other supplies. Who knows, you know, what that might be. So if you're a Sunni, then living in Iraq, and a lot of the Sunni tribal leaders actually supported ISIS or ISIL just because they were fed up with the al-Maliki regime. And the Christian Science Monitor is saying that they really don't think there's going to be that much difference with this new guy on the block, al-Abadi from al-Maliki. So the whole thing, I mean, you know, it doesn't really look, you really can't see a path out of it, besides thinking that area that the U.S. is now defending is also very rich in oil.
Well, certainly Kurdistan will come out of this either an independent country or closer to independence than before. Kurdistan is about oil. There's huge Western oil investments there. Kurdistan is relatively stable and liberal on the spectrum of things, but I'm not clear that the Peshmerga, who are known to be these fierce tribal fighters, it's kind of like a Hollywood movie. I'm not sure they can really stand up to a pounding from ISIS, and either is Obama, and I think that's why, you know, he bombed, because he's on edge that you lose, you have Kurdistan go down, might as well just blow up the dam at Mosul and wash the country away down the whole Tigris-Euphrates River. I mean, it's hard to stop once it starts. And the only point I'm making is that there may be a chance for the Sunnis to reclaim their identity in Iraq, and they may have an interest in having a power center, and you know, with control over their resources, with control over their security, and then they'll have a battle with ISIS, because why would Iraqi Sunnis want to be under a global jihadist movement with a caliphate run by one man who proclaims himself the leader of the world? I mean,
Tom.
There are tensions there.
Yeah, Tom, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there because we're literally out of time. I've got to dash out of studio. But we're going to be discussing this more Friday when you join us on our weekly roundtable, right?
I'm sure, yeah. We'll okay. know a little bit more.
We will.
And it'll be a little bit worse.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Tom Hayden. And, of course, Oil for Israel is also coming from the Kurdistan region as well. We are out of time today. Show produced by Margaret Prescott. Thanks to the Sojourner Truth team, Marielle Roski, Sherelle Withers, our engineer, Teddy Robinson, assistant producer, Kevin Walker. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
In your heart and soul, I don't hesitate.
It's 10 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. That was a program called Sojourner Truth Radio. It comes from KPFK in Los Angeles. Coming up next, it's Air Cascadia with host Chris Andre at 10:15. Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. Today, a look at Haiti. And a couple other topics. At 11 o'clock, stay tuned for the Dirt Bag with gardening tips and tricks. Today they're going to be speaking about pears, and they got a new garden stumper for you. Stay tuned for all that coming up on Community Radio KBOO.
Tune in Wednesday, August 13th at 2 p.m. when KBOO's Rita Rega will be talking to impresario George Ween, the creator of the Newport Jazz Festival. Listen to what this eyewitness to jazz history has to say about his festival and the film Jazz on a Summer's Day, playing Thursday, August 14th at the Clinton Street Theater. Again, that's George Ween, interviewed by KBOO's Rita Rega, Wednesday, August 13th, 2 p.m., here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to the Dirt Bag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty...